scene for us and read something.
So the setup for the scene is that, as you said, the daughter is coming back from a stint in prison and through rehab, and she's not seen her daughter in 5 years. And so Ray, our hero, has told her that her mother's coming. And so he's been raising his granddaughter, Sitka. And he's been out on the boat all day. It's been a tough, tough time on the ocean. He's just bone tired. And he's at home when Sitka gets home from school. Sitka throws her backpack onto the sofa cushions, gives me a once over, and scrunches her nose. God, it stinks worse in here than a boys' locker room. What if I had one of my friends with me? I yawn before answering her. Then the two of you could fix dinner together while I finish my nap. You mean there isn't any dinner? I'm starving, and I have a ton of algebra homework, and I have to finish a stupid paper in the stupid French Revolution. I wiggle my feet enough that I can stand up. I'll make a deal. You cook dinner, and I'll clean up while you do your homework. There's some scallops in the fridge that we should eat today or tomorrow. Throw them over some noodles with some butter, heat up a box of frozen spinach, and we'll call it good. Ugh, she says, but steps into the kitchen anyway. And how do you know what the boys' locker room smells like? No answer on that one. This wouldn't be the first time Sitka's made dinner. She's actually a pretty decent cook. I move back and forth on the balls of my feet, trying to get some more circulation going. Donna used to have one of those plug-in foot bath things, but God knows where it is. As I rotate my shoulder, trying to work out the kinks, I hear Sitka rummaging around, banging out pots and pans. There's a sudden loud crash, and when I limp into the kitchen, my ceramic statue of Ganesh is on the floor. Or rather, 100 charcoal-colored ceramic pieces of the Indian elf and god are scattered across the linoleum. Sitka stands over a good portion of the trunk in one eye. That's the only Ganesh I have. Sitka kicks a couple of the broken pieces. Well, why do we have to have all this junk everywhere? She's referring, no doubt, to the small Tibetan Buddha and a larger Japanese Buddha, both made out of monkey wood, the resin made to look like amber statues of Shiva, Matsu, and Laozi, and a plaster made to look like marble figurines of Demeter, Poseidon, and Horus, and about 2 dozen others made from varied materials. St. Anthony, the only fully painted figure, stands out in the crowd, which only makes sense since he is the saint of lost articles. Ganesh was the largest god in my collection, and he's left quite a gap at the edge of the kitchen countertop. You can't even move in this house. It's so crowded with this junk. Why can't we live like normal people? Did I mention that Ganesh is the god of domestic harmony? We are normal people. I swipe the broom next to the kitchen door and shove it at Sitka. Sweep up the mess you made, and I mean all of it, but save the pieces. Like I'm the only one making messes around here. But she takes the broom anyway. I don't have any space in this house. Like her bedroom suddenly disappeared into a black hole. And now your stupid daughter's coming here and probably bringing all her junk, and I won't have enough space to even breathe. As she sweeps, I get the dustpan and bend down, holding it in place for her. My legs and shoulders feel like cast iron. Why are you jumping down my throat because your mom is coming? I thought you were okay with this. Sitka sweeps up the final bits of gray and white ceramic into the dustpan and stands up, like it matters what I think. She's coming. Nobody asked me. Yeah, well, nobody asked me about it either. Sitka slides the broom back into its usual spot. She's not going to start living here, is she? She's coming just for a short visit. This is our house. I smile to reassure her, but Sitka's mouth looks like a salmon that just got hooked and barbed. I'm not expecting you to do anything differently or behave differently. I'm sure your mom just wants to see how you're doing. We'll have to see how it goes. That's all anyone can do, right? Sitka throws out her right hip and rolls her eyes. Everyone's trying to make my life miserable. I don't have a good comeback, and I really am too tired to take on any more of this tonight. Go on upstairs. I'll fix dinner. Just do your homework. Sitka turns and leaves, not happy, but not stumpy mad either. I realize I've now volunteered to do the cooking and the dishes. But I'll take that over another run-in. I still have the full dustpan in my hand. I pour the broken Ganesh into a sack. I'll take him out onto the boat and throw the broken pieces overboard into whatever reincarnation awaits him.
Thank you. That was local author Dan Byrne reading from his new debut novel, The Gods of Second Chances. It officially launches March 1st. Dan, thank you for reading that. It was very telling in that passage that the granddaughter, Sitka, refers to her own mother as your daughter.
Yes.
You know, she has no connection there.
Yes, she's not seen her for 6 years.
And she did have a connection as a very young daughter, but that was broken
yes.
early.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, so. You know, I mentioned in the introduction that Ray, the main character, is just under an intense amount of pressure from things beyond his control. And he does rely on these gods that you mentioned in the passage. Can you talk about the role of ritual and gods in Ray's life and keeping it all together?
So as Ray looks at all these forces that are around him and at the death of his wife and what's gone on, he doesn't feel in control, and so he does look for these outside forces. And part of that is his sailor superstition that goes along with that. Part, he's picked up a lot of rituals from his best friend, Felix, who's half Klingit. And they do a lot of those rituals out at sea. And as Felix reminds him, we spend most of this life being lucky and unlucky at the same time. And part of that is also that Ray is looking for these forces from the outside to help shape what should happen. But really what he needs to do is really look inside at the end of the day and look at how his own memories and how he shaped those memories affect his outlook on the world. And what he needs, and really the book is really more on the inside about what he needs to change rather than relying on these external forces.
And his reliance on these gods, multiple gods, becomes a real point of contention when his daughter Jenny shows up.
Yes. She comes back as a born-again Christian, and that does create a bit of tension between them.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to talk at all about what occurs when she finally does show up? What kind of impact does she have on that household?
She shows up, and it's not a happy, joyous occasion. Ray's doing his best to make things normal. Sika, as an 11-year-old, has her preteen moodiness that goes up and down, and she's very suspicious of her mom and not quite sure that she's going to bring anything good into this house, and very protective of what she and Ray has. And at the same time, Jenny is bringing in her own viewpoint of what's happened in their lives. And that's quite different from Ray's viewpoint. And so part of the tension in the book is how they each remember what's happened between them.
Can you talk a little bit about the backstory of Ray and Jenny, what occurred in the past before she went to prison?
They had a very close relationship when Jenny was young. So, and there's a scene where they're in Seattle, and they're on the pier, and Ray is remembering this from a photo that he finds in a house. And if you've ever been to Pike Street Market, you know that the fishmongers there throw these huge king salmons to each other, and they just smack into each other. And one day, when they're down there visiting Ray's deceased wife's parents, Donna's parents, they're watching these men throw the king salmon across, and one drops, and 7-year-old Jenny gets very upset and yells at them that they shouldn't treat dead animals that way, even though they're dead, they don't deserve that. And then looking at the photo, Ray's remembering that they're looking out on the Puget Sound and watching the ferries go across and V-shaped wakes and seagulls coming, and he's looking at the photo and seeing that Jenny's leaning into him, and they have their arms around each other. And, you know, at that point, they look like a father and daughter who love each other. And that gets forgotten, and particularly as Jenny becomes a teenager, then their relationship begins to fall apart. And, of course, here's Sika approaching that same age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the backstory really helped me to have some sympathy and understanding of the daughter character, Jenny, her sensitivity and her sense of justice, mm-hmm. you know, and speaking up in cases of injustice. You know, it was very interesting. And also, I think that sensitivity can, you know, be a characteristic of people who can end up abusing drugs. You know, there's that. It really helped flesh her out and gave me a lot of empathy for her, because she's not easy to enjoy.
She's not.
For part of the book.
For part of the book. Yeah. Yeah, she's not the easiest person to get along. But she does have her own valid viewpoints about mm-hmm. what's going on.
And that comes out as the book progresses. We're speaking with Dan Byrne about his debut novel, The Gods of Second Chances, that launches officially March 1st. And you launch at PALS. Let's go ahead and mention your actual launch party at PALS City of Books.
Yay, PALS City of Books. You know, what Ann Patchett calls the mothership of all bookstores, independent bookstores, which is great. I think it's the dream of every local author anyway to do their launch reading at PALS. So that's going to be Sunday, March 9th, not this Sunday, Oscar Day. No. Sunday, March 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the PALS City of Books on Burnside. Very exciting. And I'm very excited that Karen Carbo is going to do the introduction. So Karen Carbo fans, and I know there's many, many, many of you, come on out too.
And you've been in her writing workshop for a decade. That's amazing.
Yes.
Wow. The title of this book, The Gods of Second Chances, you know, the big theme of the book is second chances. And second chances hinge on forgiveness. And that seems to be the driving need of this book. The father, Ray, and his estranged daughter, Jenny, they have a deep wound.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about what the source of that wound is and the how they see that the past very differently?
So the wound is many faceted, but the big part is the death of Ray's wife and Jenny's mom. And Ray absolutely, in his mind and in his heart, blames Jenny for that death. He blames her for when she was a teenager and what she was doing with the crowd she hanged out with and what she did with drugs and how that impacted their marriage. And then there's a scene, which I won't describe because I want you to read it, a very terrible, horrible death.
Harrowing
death. For Donna, Ray's wife. And he blames it on her. And at the same time, Jenny is looking back and saying, well, let's look at all those things that you did to drive me away. Let's look at what you didn't do. Let's look at the relationship that we had and how did that impact us. And so those two forces have to forgive, but before they can forgive, they have to come to terms inside what's gone on and honestly deal with that.
This book really spoke to me as a daughter. I think it would speak to many people. You know, just the what can occur between a daughter and a father when the daughter becomes a woman, the relationship shifts. And I think fathers sometimes have a hard time keeping up.
My daughter, who's a wonderful writer herself, once told me that, you know, I think you liked me best when I was seven. You know, I think she told me that when she was in college. And there's some truth in that fathers, you know, like to think about their daughter, even though, you know, she's grown, she has children herself, and as I said, a great writer in her own right. Fathers, we like to sometimes think of them as just little people there. Are, you know, the ones who are leaning into us with their arms around each other.
Gave me a lot of insight into my own father, I must say. Thank you for that. Yeah, a lot of deep stuff happening in this book. It was really an interesting read. And, you know, another thing about Ray, the father, and his strange daughter, Jenny, they have very, very different perceptions and memories about the past. And it really highlights that so often family dysfunction, divided families, you know, everybody has their story.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you can sit down and you know, really dig deep and get it out, you know, it's very difficult to come to any understanding or healing and forgiveness.
Yeah, I've come from a fairly large family, and you asked any two of us what happened at a particular incident when we were young, and you'll get some different stories.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is also a story. I don't know if this was an intention of yours, but Ray is a man surrounded by women. It seems, it feels like he's, and it's almost like he's in a foreign land that he cannot navigate. I don't know if that was intentional or not.
Gosh, I learned I came from the writing group. For a long time, I was the only guy writer in the writing group. Maybe that influenced it.
You know, when I read a book, I really, you know, I love it when writers can illuminate some aspect of the human condition. And, you know, it helps us all, I think, understand a little bit more about what we're here to do. And there was a line I would like to read, if you'll allow me.
Sure.
That I think gives the listener a sense of some of the passages of the book they can look forward to. Ray, do you want to set the scene? Ray used to, as a young man, work on the slime line, you call it, processing red king crabs.
Yes, just when Jenny was born and his wife Donna was still down in Seattle, Ray goes up to find work. And the work that he can find is processing salmon in the canneries, and which they call it the slime line, because that's how it gets.
And you, in this scene, he's remembering when he was processing red king crabs on the slime line one day, and they had to break off the long legs and package them up and send them off to fish markets around the world, and they would throw the bodies, the rest of the king crab, away. And here's Ray's thought. I used to wonder how the crabs felt about that. And then I wondered whether our own lives come down to that. The parts of ourselves we value so much, our minds, our hearts, how often these were discarded in favor of what someone else wanted from us. That got me. I love that.
Great. Yeah, I think that's one of the questions that Ray has to explore in the book, both from how he values people and how people value him, and how he values Sitka and Jenny. And mm-hmm.
There's one other woman we haven't brought up, Nicole. Would you like to talk about her presence in this book and how she adds to Ray's dilemma?
Nicole's a newcomer up to the island, up from Seattle, and they meet as Ray takes out a group of tourists to go fishing to help make some more money, and they are very attracted to each other. And but Nicole has her own past and what she's getting away from, and she is someone who Ray would really, really love to get together with, but can't. And he makes a choice. And I'm not going to go too far into the details, but he has to make a choice whether to be with this woman who he's obviously falling in love with, or if he's going to have the best chance with his granddaughter. Mm-hmm. And he has to make that choice, and it's a painful one.
And he made that his timing in making that choice was not ideal. From a woman's perspective, that's all I'm going to say about that.
And my wonderful editor, Laura Stanfill, and I had many wonderful conversations about that.
You know, one of the pleasures of reading this book, The Gods of Second Chances by local author Dan Byrne, one of the pleasures was the illustrations. Not only the cover is incredible, it's by
Gigi Little.
She's on the staff of Forest Avenue Press.
Yes,
and she did it. It's really an eye-catching cover featuring Tlingit art, mm-hmm. fish, and then inside, there are illustrations at the beginning of each chapter by local artist Reed Saltis. Is that the proper way to say it?
That is.
And the internal drawings are almost characters in and of themselves. Have you described these images? Do you have the words to convey what they might, how they operate within the book?
So there's a part in the book, a very small scene, where Ray is bemoaning to Felix about another island where some of the Tlingit totems are, And he's saying, you know, it's a shame. You know, you guys, you don't go out there and take care of those totems. They just, like, keep sliding into the sea, and there, you know, there goes Wolf, there goes Bear, there goes Raven, just down. And Felix says, well, you know, that's how life is. You know, you can't fight the whole death and decaying thing. And so, so we took that idea, and Reed, we didn't want to do an exact duplicate, and did not want to dishonor any native folks and people who actually do these. So they're like sketches of real animals, but sort of in a totem shape.
An orca, grizzly, salmon, raven, seal, wolf, and crab.
Yeah. So as the book goes on, at first you think, oh, this is just, you know, this is a nice illustration, and then you see that they are going into the ocean. Into the sea as the story progresses. And I think it adds a really great visual cue about what's going on.
It was really cool. The balance that they have initially is slowly.
You get a little wobbly.
Yeah, and then, as you can imagine, and it really underscores the tension. It helps to heighten the tension in the book and underscore what's happening in the narrative. It was really creative. And I would encourage listeners to check out this artist's website. His name again, Reed Saltis, and his website is Reed Saltis. I'll spell that REIDPSALTIS.com. Check it out. Dan, do you mind telling folks about some of the upcoming events? Again, repeating your launch at Powell's, and then what else you have coming up so they can come out and see you?
So we've got the launch reading at Powell's Sunday, March 9th at 7:30. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be the book's going to be featured in the article in the Register Guard this Sunday, which is not an event, but it's still fun.
Yeah.
We are going to I'm going to be doing a reading with the wonderful Stephen Allred at Clackamas Community College on March 13th from noon to 1. Be at Rain or Shine Coffee House on March 20th, and that's with the Oregon Writers Colony, a great group, great, wonderful writing sponsors and group. And then Broadway Books on April 24th. And I'm going to be reading there with Rob Yardumian, who wrote Sound of Songs Across the Water. I know, Sound of Songs Across the Water. So it's just wonderful to have the launch and then continue reading with these other great writers in the Portland area.
And the book, The Gods of Second Chances, is available in print and e-form at independent bookstores and online in the usual places. And I found out this morning that these incredible internal illustrations are also part of any e-book offering that people might get.
Yes, to show up. That was a nice surprise.
I mentioned in the beginning that this is the first novel release by Forest Avenue Press, and the publisher, Laura Stanfill, is just doing such great work in our community to support local authors and Oregon writers and quiet stories, all the things that are not getting highlighted in New York City. I was just curious, how did it feel to get that phone call that your novel had been chosen?
The best thing about it was that with Laura and with Forest Avenue, there's excitement about getting a novel being published, but really, 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 it was really like, wow, I found a home. You know, this Laura's idea about quiet books with strong characters and story together just really resonated with me. So this is a place I want to be. And of course, we've got Stephen, and we got a series of short stories coming out from Forest Avenue Press, coming out in May, edited by the great Liz Prado. And we got also Kate Gray's novel will be coming out from there in September, Skin Drag. And so it's just a great home to be.
Check out Forest Avenue Press, all you writers and readers out there. And you can learn more about Dan Byrne and the Gods of Second Chances on his website, danbyrne.com, danbyrne.com. I'm Leanne Kranz. Thank you for listening to Between the Covers. Up next, The Film Show.
KABU is sponsoring an evening on the future of schooling in Portland at the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, March 13th. It starts at 6 p.m. with a panel discussion that addresses what's ahead for public schools after the recent fierce contract battle, the case against high-stakes testing in privatizing schools, why public schools produce higher test score performances than private schools, and how we can work together to create truly wonderful schools. Speakers include Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Teachers Union, also school board member Steve Buell, and folks from the High School Student Union and Oregon Save Our Schools, a parent group. After discussion, we will present the film The Inconvenient Truth About Waiting for Superman. It's a film that debunks the attack on public education and teachers' unions. It all happens on Thursday, March 13th at the Clinton Street Theater at 6 p.m.
Oh, that stupid car.
Yeah, it was kind of a POS, wasn't it?
It was such a junker. We were going to donate it to the radio station.
Oh, do they accept vehicle donations?
Yes, that was the plan, you goofball. We were going to donate it to KABU, but no. Instead, what happens? We leave it in the stupid yard, and then Bigfoot comes.
Yeah, he took it off our hands.
Yeah, he took it. He took our car. It's not like we can deduct Grand Theft Sasquatch from our taxes. We could have taken it off on our taxes if we brought it to KABU.
Don't let this happen to you. Donate your vehicle to KABU Community Radio before Bigfoot steals it. For more information, call 877-526-6123 or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizzas, salads, and wraps, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
I'm SW Conser, and I'm joined live in the studio today by Apolline Traoré. She is a visiting filmmaker from Burkina Faso, and she is going to be, she is going to be screening her feature film, Moi Zafira, at the Cascade Festival of African Films. In fact, today, this afternoon, is going to be one screening, and then again on Saturday. Welcome, Apolline Traoré.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined in the studio today by Allison Mobley. She is the communications director for the Cascade Festival of African Films. Allison, welcome back to KABU.
Thank you so much for having us.
So tell us, Allison, first off, before we get to talking about Moi Zafira, tell us about the Cascade Festival of African Films. It's usually running through February, but it's been extended this year.
Yes, this is the 24th Cascade Festival of African Films, and it's at PCC Cascade Campus. And because of the wonderful snow we had the second week of February, all the films that were canceled due to snow have been rescheduled for March 6th, 7th, and 8th. And people can check out our website, africanfilmfestival.org, to see those times and schedule. And all the films are free, so we welcome everyone to come on out.
Well, it is an amazing festival. We had Family Day this year. We've had more focus on women filmmakers, and part of that is Apolline Traoré's appearance here in Portland. I hope that Portland has been treating you well, Apolline.
Yeah, so far, this rain is a welcoming thing for us. When you get to a place and then it rains, it's a welcome.
Well, that's wonderful. You've been down in California, I believe. You've been touring behind Moi Zafira.
Yes.
So tell us about the film. This is Moi Zafira. The title character is a very interesting rural widow and mother. And I don't want to give spoilers away, but man, the adventures that she encounters, and many of them unintentional, it's quite an odyssey.
Yes, I mean, it's about a woman that fights for what she believes her daughter should be. It's basically just a regular mother who is somewhere in her environment where she sees that there's certain things that are bad for her. It might not be bad for everybody, but she has a belief, and then the story is about her fighting for what she believes in.
What interested me about the character of Zafira is she's so well-rounded. She's not just a hero. She's conflicted about staying in her village rather than going to the city. And at some points, I felt a little bit unsympathetic because her daughter wants to be a nurse, and she says, no, you're going to be a model. Mm-hmm. But then we find out, and I don't want to reveal too much, but we find out how medical personnel are often treated in rural parts of West Africa, that they might not be as well compensated as miners, and their profession might be almost as dangerous.
No, definitely. I mean, if you look at the medical world in our countries, is you look at doctors that are on motorbikes, and they're really, and especially when they work for the government, it's worse because their compensation is really, really low. And sometimes, like in big hospital, for example, there's so many people and they're so crowded, and then a lot of people will say that they don't care, but they have so many so much work to do with no equipment, and it's very, very difficult for her, for them. And for in the film, yes, she want her daughter to be a model just because she sees that this is beauty, this is fame, and that's all she's looking for. She doesn't understand what being a model is. Either she understands what being a doctor is. So for her, the only thing that she wants is for this daughter to be that beauty that she thinks that is the best for her daughter.
One of the really striking things about the film, about Moaz Zafira, is the black and white photography, which, especially in the night scenes, it really adds an element. Tell us why you chose black and white for this film.
In the beginning of the film, she the first 10 minutes, she really tells us how bad she's feeling and how she doesn't really want to live in the country and in a village, but at the same time she doesn't want to leave because she doesn't think that other places is better. So she's not well. She hates everybody because she thinks that everybody in the villages are lazy, that they're not pushing themselves. They're waiting for food from some organization, and so no one is trying to do anything. And this is